Return to topic number two. On October 2, 1975, while cheery promises of economic recovery were emanating from Washington, the largest financial collapse in retailing history occurred. The huge W.T. Grant department store chain, with over 1,000 stores in 40 states, filed for protection under Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Act. Tempted by the booming years of the late 1960s and early 1970s, the chain had expanded at breakneck speed and was caught high and dry when our economy began to crumble 2 years ago. Suddenly, in the changed economic environment, Grant simply could not find enough buyers for its goods to cover its liabilities. Bankruptcy came with the chain owing over $1 billion, more than all of its assets put together. But companies are not the only things that can go bankrupt. On October 2, 1975, a major firm that rates government bonds suddenly and completely suspended all ratings on New York City bonds. It had become apparent that the city's finances were in bad, bad trouble. New York City, like W.T. Grant, was in over its head. Frantic maneuverings ensued in order to try to keep New York City afloat, including creation of the Municipal Assistance Corporation, or Big Mac, as it is often called. With that, New York State was drawn into the city's tangle of financial woes, and now the state's bond ratings are on the way down, too. Experts confirm what is all too obvious to everyone. It is now only a matter of time until New York State and city default on their crushing debts as they come due. The result will be legal and financial panic and confusion as creditors, city employees, welfare recipients, bondholders, and others are thrown into a battle to try to get their money. City services will be cut back. Unemployment in New York will skyrocket due to layoffs. People who have put their life savings into so-called safe New York City bonds will be in danger of seeing it all go up in smoke. This is the exact situation that I warned disbelieving Wall Street bond traders about in a seminar in January of this year, 1975. All of this is likely to happen within just a few weeks. Just in time for Christmas, unless federal or quasi-federal authorities step into the picture with some sort of temporary bailout scheme. But will this happen? One of the main contingent plans of the Rockefeller brothers is to let New York go down the drain. They themselves bailed out months ago so that they will not personally suffer if New York goes bankrupt. Therefore, they are in a perfect position to use the state and city's financial collapse for three purposes. First, to trigger the general economic collapse for which they have worked so long. Second, to be able to label our coming crash the Ford Depression, so that Nelson Rockefeller can then ride out on his white horse, like FDR did 42 years ago, proclaiming himself our savior. And third, to convince the American people that the United States Congress has become a totally worthless institution, so that the Congress can be abolished in the course of setting up their new constitution and dictatorship. The plight of New York City and state, after all, is not unique, as you may think. The deteriorating financial condition of all the government bodies, with local governments least able to fight back, is a deliberate and predictable product of the economic forces unleashed by the Rockefeller brothers 4 years ago. The era of stagflation and monetary instability entered its current phase in the spring of 1971 through Rockefeller manipulation of their multinational corporations. In my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, published in 1973, I called it Campaign May. I now quote, starting on page 32. It happened on Signal. It was May 1971. The affiliates of the multinationals armed with dollars, opened their spring offensive. They dropped bombs of dollars on Europe. The Europeans, as they had attempted in 1967-1968, tried again to rescue the American dollar. The multinationals sent waves and waves of dollars against the central bankers until these bankers were compelled to stop supporting the dollar by giving out high fixed-price currencies. The time had come to think of their own currencies and what they were doing to their own economies. The dollar began to float. It had become free from a fixed rate in relation to other European currencies. It had, in effect, become devalued, softer, unquote. Then came August 15, 1971. Mark it well, my friends, the date when our current inflation really began. August 15, 1971. The Rockefellers, through their government lackeys, persuaded President Nixon to repudiate the 1944 Bretton Woods Monetary Agreement by suspending settlement of international transactions in gold, since the Rockefeller brothers had already stolen almost all of America's gold by then. This action, severing the dollar from gold, set in motion an inflationary force greater than America had ever experienced in the 20th century. Continuing on page 81 of my book, the predictable effect on governmental bodies such as New York City was pointed out as follows, and I quote, "The waves of campaign May had reached the shores of America. The war against the dollar in Europe was coming home to Americans in the form of high prices and social unrest. The impact of the econo-strategic and econo-politic measures of the new imperialism of the Rockefeller brothers will be felt for many years in the United States. The legislative bodies of the local, state, and federal government will be incapable of coping with the situation we call stagflation, that is, the problem previously referred to of high inflation combined with a lack of real growth in the economy." Still quoting, "After two official devaluations followed by unofficial devaluations as a result of the floating dollar, the value of the dollar in terms of goods and services bought is going down and down, buying less and less. Devaluation of the dollar is a presage of increased inflation. The burden of devaluation ultimately falls on the average working man, the pensioner, and those on fixed incomes. It erodes savings accounts, bonds, and other fixed income instruments. It also takes more dollars for local, state, and federal programs," unquote. Thus, thanks to the stagflation era, launched deliberately by the Rockefeller brothers several years ago, mounting deficits by New York City were inevitable, as they simply tried to maintain programs and services which had begun under a non-stagflationary economy. The same applies to the federal government itself, which is now running a record deficit half again as large as that experienced at the height of World War II. If the point is reached when New York cannot pay its massive obligations to creditors, then at least some of those creditors will in turn have trouble paying off their obligations and loans. This process can therefore ripple through our general economy. But in normal, non-stagflation times, it would die out and be absorbed after some point. But the American economy is now dangerously top-heavy with debt, much of it owned, by the way, to the huge major banks, insurance companies, and the Federal Reserve System, all controlled by the Rockefellers, who therefore stand to pick up an awful lot of property through foreclosures. Recent figures indicate that corporations, taken all together, have twice as much debt as liquid assets. Worse yet, 2 years ago we passed the point at which the total debt of the United States governmental, business, and personal, exceeded our total assets. In other words, our whole country is now like a great big W.T. Grant operating with a negative net worth. Should our nation's debt structure collapse badly in one spot, say New York City, the whole thing can start falling down progressively, like a house of cards. There is no solid, debt-free financial underpinning left to absorb this process and make it fizzle out. One way or another, therefore, it is only now a question of time whether the government and or the Federal Reserve will leap into our collapsing economic situation and their so-called solution for our problems will come down ultimately to printing more dollars. Inflation will then skyrocket even faster than now. Any remaining confidence in the dollar will be shattered. And all of this will come along just in time to send gold prices streaking upward under the conditions which David Rockefeller has labored so hard to finally achieve. I discussed this last month in connection with the IMF gold sale decision, and everything is still very much on track there. On the weekend of October 5, 1975, just 10 days ago, a secret meeting was held in New York City by delegates of the United States, Britain, Japan, France, and West Germany to lay the groundwork for a Western Economic Summit to be held later this year. David Rockefeller is trying to make sure that the January 1976 meeting of the IMF in Jamaica will reach a compromise agreement acceptable to France on the matter of exchange rates, so that the conditional gold agreement reached last month will then take effect. My current information is that to satisfy France, stable yet flexible exchange rates between currencies will be defined in terms of gold. Gold will be officially fixed at or about $195 an ounce for this purpose. This being the first of several successive stages within a period of 2.5 years from today, with gold ultimately targeted to reach $2,000 per ounce. So bankruptcy of New York City, if it comes, will serve the Rockefeller brothers well in their scheme to bring America to submission economically. And after spending months telling President Ford, both directly and through advisors, not to help New York City, Nelson Rockefeller has suddenly hopped on the other side of the fence and now says for public consumption that federal authority should help New York. But this is only lip service, my friends. For behind the scenes, he is still making sure that ultimately nothing is done. Now, when the ultimate collapse comes, it will be President Ford, not Nelson Rockefeller, the real culprit, who is blamed for not effecting a rescue. Along with Ford, Congress will also be the loser in all of this. On October 11, 1975, when Rockefeller went public with his statements in support of New York, he said in a speech which, please note, he did not bother to clear with his puppet Ford, and I quote, "After the control board in New York City have acted to restore fiscal integrity, it will be a true test of the responsiveness of our congressional system as to whether the Congress can act in time to avoid catastrophe," unquote. This is the very same Nelson Rockefeller who, as governor of New York State, increased New York State taxes by over 500% and its debt by over 300%, and drove numerous industries, including some of his own, out of the state by confiscatory taxation. But you can rest assured that Congress will now be watched very closely by the Rockefeller mass media to see what they do about all of this. Thus, the Rockefellers are trying to make us think of New York City's fate as a criterion for the continued usefulness or lack thereof of Congress. And regardless of what Congress does, they intend to make sure that Congress does not pass the public opinion test. So, my friends, don't be too mystified by the strange things going on around us. Keep your eyes focused on causes, not effects, because what man makes, he can unmake. In the 1920s, the Rockefellers brought a very sophisticated German economist to America from Berlin to work out a plan to massage the stock market in order, so they said, to try to deflate inflation. But once they had his plan, they promptly twisted it and used it to bring about the stock market crash of 1929. He resigned in disgust and went into a religious retreat, but later became a university professor. It was my privilege to have studied under this man, and we became good and close friends. It was he, my wise German professor, who taught me finance, banking, and economics, and who confidentially taught me to forget all about the effects the economists had written about in their books, even including his, and to focus instead on causes and the way these effects can be brought about. He died with shame in his heart because of the cruel way in which the Rockefellers had warped and misused what he had taught them in good faith. His identity must remain a secret. But he left with me a heavy responsibility to use what he had taught me for good. And that is what I am trying to do now for you and for him. Topic number 3. Perhaps you're wondering why I have chosen to talk today about preparations for our new American Constitution and maneuverings for a new Asian war. All is one topic. The reason is that both are parts of the larger Rockefeller plan for world conquest and one Rockefeller world government as outlined in Hoffman Nickerson's Rockefeller-authorized book, The American Rich, published in 1930. On previous occasions, I have alluded to the fact that Japan, since World War II, has been substantially under the thumb of the four Rockefeller brothers, and in particular of John D. Rockefeller III. It was John, as I explained in audio letter number 3, who helped pave the way for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor through his spy ring activities under the cloak of the Institute of Pacific Relations. If you had any doubts about what I have told you of the Rockefeller control over Japan, I hope you paid close attention to the recent visit by Emperor Hirohito to our country. From start to finish, with scarcely a break, he was in Rockefeller company on Rockefeller turf, from the colonial Williamsburg, Virginia tourist attraction owned by the Rockefellers to Vice President Nelson Rockefeller's Japanese-style house in Pocantico Hills. Our figurehead President Ford and other officials hardly even counted. Nelson's brother John, who is heading the publicity campaign for their own new constitution under the banner of a second American revolution, is still up to his old tricks in the Pacific, too. On September 15, 1975, a significant article appeared in the Vancouver Province newspaper describing a hush-hush meeting that was not even reported in the United States. The article was entitled, quote, Rockefeller's Brain Trust Meeting Ends, unquote, and reads in part as follows, and I quote, an informal conference of some of the Pacific Rim's most influential political and economic thinkers, convened by financier John D. Rockefeller III, ended here Saturday, and only then was the list of participants released. The 43 guests invited to the Williamsburg Five Conference from Southeast Asia, Australia, and North America met for 4 days in off-the-record sessions representing only themselves, not their organizations. Still quoting, participants included George Ball, former U.S. Undersecretary of State, Derek Davies, editor of the authoritative Far Eastern Economic Review, Newsweek editor Osborne Elliott, Exxon chairman C.C. Garvin, United States Senate Minority Leader Hugh Scott, Mitsubishi Research Director Morishi Mori, and Toman Tanat, former Thai Foreign Minister. Other guests included top-level experts from Asian and United States companies, publications, banks, universities, various ministries, and presidential circles. Unquote. In a news conference after the meeting, Robert Barnett, director of the Washington Center of the Asia Society, was asked what effect the discussions would have on the foreign policy of various countries. And he answered, quote, "I would say the probability of direct influence is very small, and the probability of indirect influence is very considerable," unquote. It is mentioned that the conferences began in Williamsburg, Virginia, 5 years ago to discuss, quote, "the then new breakthrough in United States-Chinese relations," unquote. The Rockefeller brothers are maneuvering rapidly to bring on the Asian War, which they plan to ignite in March 1977 as their target date. Their goal is to take over India, the former crown jewel of the British Empire, which is rich in iron ore, precious metals, and various other natural resources, as well as cheap labor. Already 1,000 or so inhabitants of a small island in the Indian Ocean, Diego Garcia, are being involuntarily relocated elsewhere to make room for the rapid buildup of a U.S. naval base in preparation for the coming war in that area. Henry Kissinger's new controversial Sinai Accord involving 200 so-called civilian technicians to be placed in no man's land between Israel and Egypt is also a part of the global preparations for Asian war by the Rockefellers. The primary focus right now is not the Middle East itself, but Asia. Israel is, in effect, to become our advanced base for American military operations when we are drawn into the Asian conflict on the side of Russia and India and against the Sino-Japanese axis, which through Japan will also be under Rockefeller influence. Huge amounts of arms are being pumped into Israel with much smaller token amounts promised to Egypt. Israel is being used while the Arabs are being placated for now to keep the region's oil supply secure for the planned war. Those so-called civilian technicians will be civilian in name only. They are actually the advanced command nuclei of the American military buildup in the Sinai that is already going on in secret. The whole purpose of this is not fundamentally to protect the Israelis and the Egyptians from one another, but to keep open the American supply line to the east for war in India. Should India fall through subversion before 1977, the war now brewing will no longer be necessary. In that event, the Rockefeller plans will revert to those described in my audio book number 1, released a year ago, World War III, with America the primary nuclear battlefield, beginning just a little later than the war now planned. For that purpose, the Rockefeller brothers have as their ace in the hole the Panama Canal. It is already targeted by atomic missiles in the Republic of Guyana in Latin America. And while negotiations proceed to return partial sovereignty over the canal zone to Panama, the United States is negotiating to retain the right to defend the canal indefinitely in case of attack. The Panama Canal will thus be the new Pearl Harbor, and we are to be dragged into nuclear war in its defense under that contingent war plan of the Rockefeller brothers. Meanwhile, here at home, the Rockefellers are already making war, propaganda war, economic war, and political war on us, the peasants, as they call us. As I explained in my audio book, The Secret New Constitution for America, the Rockefellers have several contingency plans through which their new constitution may potentially be put into effect, and they are keeping all of them alive. The primary plan is still for us to accept it by the national referendum in the midst of economic chaos a year from now. But earlier this year, for example, House Concurrent Resolution No. 28 was introduced, calling for a constitutional convention to be called and complete its work before July 4, 1976. Under this resolution, one of the co-chairmen would be the Senate President Pro Tem That is, Nelson Rockefeller. Meanwhile, the piecemeal dismantling of our constitutional rights is continuing. One of the more notorious examples lately has been Senate Bill No. 1, sponsored by a whole flock of Senate stars when it was introduced, ranging from Senator John McClellan, who ought to have known better, all the way down to Nelson Rockefeller's water boy, Birch Bayh. Senate Bill No. 1 is a 2-inch-thick complete revision of the Federal Criminal Code, with some hair-raising provisions carefully buried all through it. One of these would amount to an official secrets act, imposing criminal penalties on anyone who might dare to publicly expose errors or misdeeds by government officials. Another provision, which ties in with the increasingly shrill cries for gun control to disarm us prior to our enslavement, would effectively remove your right to defend yourself in your own home. But these are only proposals so far. Other things are taking effect now. For example, another portent of Rockefeller's proposed electoral branch of government is present in the Justice Department, which is usurping local authority over the conduct of elections all over America through tools provided by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. For a sobering account about this, I refer you to the front page of the September 29, 1975 issue of the Daily News Digest, Post Office Box 27496, Phoenix, Arizona, 85061. And speaking of the Justice Department, Attorney General Edward Leavy recently took the unprecedented step of placing the FBI under his direct, immediate control. There exists no more dangerous Rockefeller agent in our entire government than Leavy. All of these things are very clearly spelled out in the secret new Rockefeller Constitution. But they are only the beginning, my friends. The 10-year, multi-million-dollar study that produced their horrendous new document was funded by the Rockefeller brothers through their controlled foundations. And no clear statement of the evil philosophy that motivates the new Constitution is possible than the one given by McGeorge Bundy, the Rockefeller insider who is president of their controlled Ford Foundation. He has been quoted as saying, "It is better for man to build his own heaven on earth than to seek heaven in heaven through blood on a cross," unquote. This, my friends, is the true philosophy of the four Rockefeller brothers. They strive for their brand of a heaven on earth for themselves, even if that means hell on earth for all the rest of us. Until next month, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.